Tommy McNeil. A top advisor to President Trump indicates the president is prepared to issue the first veto of his term amid a wave of negativity from Congress to his declaration of a national emergency along the U.S.-Mexico border, AP correspondent Ben Thomas.
First and foremost, I don't think we needed a national emergency declaration.
And Republican Congressman Will Hurd, whose Texas district is on the Mexico border, tells CBS's Face the Nation,
our government wasn't designed to operate by national emergency.
But White House advisor Stephen Miller tells Fox News Sunday,
Congress in 1976 passed the National Emergencies Act and gave the president the authority as a result of that to invoke a national emergency in many different circumstances, but among them for the use of military construction funds.
Democrats on Capitol Hill are planning to introduce a resolution disapproving of the president's emergency declaration. Ben Thomas, Washington.
President Trump said Sunday big progress is being made in U.S. trade talks with China on what he calls so many different fronts. Mr. Trump said last week he might put off the March 1st deadline to increase tariffs on China if a trade deal is close. But a China trade expert who served in the Obama administration says he has only seen incremental progress toward a trade deal with China. Moon Jae-in, president, believes negotiators on both sides are failing to address the real reason the U.S. imposed stiff sanctions on China in the first place. Allegations that it is stealing U.S. intellectual property and China's demands that U.S. firms turn over trade secrets if they want to keep doing business in China. Dozens of female relatives of Islamic State fighters in the refugee camps of Mosul have faced harassment and sexual abuse at the hands of Iraqi security forces. That is according to a joint report this week by the Network of Iraqi Reporters for Investigative Journalism and the Mosul Investigation Team. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The battle for Islamic State's last territory in Syria continued over the weekend. With militants facing certain defeat, questions remain over what will happen to the survivors and U.S. plans to withdraw its troops from the country. We get more from Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda.
U.S. plans to gradually withdraw from Syria after this battle, which has alarmed its allies. The loss of Islamic State's territory doesn't mean the group is eradicated. When IS lost its territory in Iraq, for example, they went underground and still routinely carry out attacks there. The United Nations estimates there may be up to 18,000 IS fighters loose in the two countries. There's also the matter of what happens to the Kurds. They were the backbone of U.S. efforts in Syria, given American weapons, advisors, air support. But another big player here, Turkey, considers the Kurds as terrorists. And without the U.S., they're now moving closer to Russia and Syrian President Assad for protection.
That's Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda. An upcoming meeting in Pakistan between a delegation of the United States and Taliban representatives has been canceled, according to information coming from both sides. A Taliban leader confirmed on a condition of anonymity that the meeting was canceled by the Americans. A Taliban statement issued later in the day said the talks were postponed because many members of its 14-person negotiating team were unable to go overseas since they are on the U.S. and U.N. blacklist. Several of them are on the U.N. Security Council sanctions list, which bars them from international travel. U.S. Senator Marco Rubio visiting the Colombia-Venezuela border Sunday warned Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro of severe consequences if he takes action against the country's opposition leader and self-declared president or U.S. citizens. In a televised interview, Rubio declared and declined to say if he would support U.S. military action against Venezuela, which is mired in a political and economic crisis. Senator Rubio visited aid operations on the Colombian side of the Venezuelan border and said the Venezuelan people have had a positive impact on Americans.
They remind us how valuable liberty and freedom is. They remind us how important it is to always preserve it and why we should be willing to fight for it no matter how long it takes.
Rubio also warned Maduro against harming U.S. personnel working in the country and said the United States would also respond if aid workers were targeted. Yemeni officials and Houthi rebels have agreed on a phase one of a mutual pullback of forces from the key city of Hodeidah. Without giving any details of the agreement, U.N. officials call it important progress. A pullback from Hodeidah was part of December's ceasefire between Iranian-backed Houthi rebels and the Saudi-supported Yemeni forces. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today's Monday, February 18th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's Electoral Commission reassures a fuming public over election delay.
We know that people are disappointed, but we are also encouraged by the fact that people understand that in the last 3 years, we have demonstrated that we are capable of conducting free, fair, and credible elections.
Rotimi Oyekemen is Chief Press Secretary to Nigeria's Electoral Commission Chairman. More bodies have been recovered from a collapsed mine in Zimbabwe. South Sudan has a unique but controversial way to finance its peace agreement. And Kenya and Somalia are involved in a maritime diplomatic row.
The government of Kenya cannot and will not stand by as its demarches are ignored and its territorial integrity is infringed upon and its sovereign resources are carved out and shared out by an ungracious and unbrotherly neighbor.
Macharia Kamau is Kenya's Foreign Affairs Principal Secretary, and Gambia's Truth, Reconciliation and Reparation Commission visits former President Yahya Jammeh's torture chambers. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission, known as INEC, has again appealed to a fuming Nigerian public to trust its judgment over the postponement of last Saturday's election. The commission postponed the February 16 election, citing problems in the distribution of ballot papers and results sheets, as well as sabotage after three fires at its offices. The reassuring comes as critics say the delay has set Nigeria's democracy back by 50 years. Others say the postponement could cost the economy an estimated $1.5 billion. Rotimi Oyekemen is the chief press secretary to INEC chairman Makmun Yakubu. He says although Nigerians are disappointed, the commission is encouraged by their understanding that INEC has conducted free, fair and credible elections in the past years.
As you are aware, on Saturday we were supposed to have the first night of the general election, but unfortunately the commission could not go ahead with that election because of some hiccups that we faced. The major hiccup was our inability to deliver some election materials to certain areas due to bad weather. The aircraft that were supposed to fly those materials to those destinations could not fly. The commission then took the decision to put those materials on long-haulage trucks that are slow, and of course they could not make it to their destination in good time. And the option will have been to go ahead with the election but delay the opening of polls or engage in what people call staggered elections. And the commission did not want to do that because that would now erode the confidence of Nigerians.
Rotimi, can I ask you, the inability to deliver these materials, was this something that the commission did not plan for?
Well, we have a peculiar situation in Nigeria. Nigerians are litigation-happy people. You know, political parties are supposed to hold their primaries, but there are so many issues coming out of this primary such that the commission was dragged to court over 600 times with the joint suits and all of that. And when judgments are given, if we place ballot papers, for instance, there is a new judgment that a political party should be on the ballot, a particular candidate should be on the ballot, then it will mean that we cannot use that ballot because the court has decided. So these issues about court orders and court judgments, which is something that we have to have a conversation with after this general election, is also part of the problem. So it leaves a very slim window of about 1 month for the commission to print all the ballot papers. But when all the ballot papers have been printed, over 421 million ballot papers have been printed. We have about 73 parties taking part in this presidential election. That's 73 candidates. Overall, we have 23,000 candidates taking part in all the elections.
Is the commission concerned that this postponement, that this could affect turnout this coming Saturday?
We regret all inconveniences, and we know that people are disappointed. But we are also encouraged by the fact that people understand that we have demonstrated in the last 3 years that we are a serious-minded commission. We have conducted about 195 different types of elections. We run election by election and governorship election. And we have demonstrated that we are capable of conducting free, fair, and credible elections. Yes, it could affect the turnout, but in the course of the week, we are going to go all out to encourage people not to be discouraged, because this is not something that the commission really enjoyed doing. It was a very, very painful decision, but it was necessary because, you know, the type of outcome that Nigerians are waiting for is what we must give to them. That is free and fair general elections. And we need to take this painful decision because of that. And I hope that in the course of the week, with the assistance of stakeholders, religious leaders, traditional rulers, and even the political parties themselves, people will be galvanized to come out and vote next Saturday.
Rotimi Oyakhemen is the Chief Press Secretary to Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission Chairman, Makmun Yakubu. He was speaking with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Kenya has set conditions for the resolution of a maritime diplomatic row that heightened over the weekend, leading to Kenya recalling its ambassador to Somalia and ordering Somalia's envoy out of Kenya. This came after Kenya accused Somalia of auctioning off oil and gas blocks that Kenya says are in its territorial waters. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, Somalia has refuted the Kenyan allegations.
Kenya has been at the forefront in East Africa to ensure peace in the neighboring countries, including offering humanitarian services to displaced people, especially those from Somalia. But on Saturday, things fell apart between the two countries when Kenya recalled its envoy to Somalia, Ambassador Lucas Tumbo, and asked Somalia to immediately withdraw its Ambassador Mahmoud Ahmed Noor from Kenya. The diplomatic tit-for-tat followed an allegation by Kenya that Somalia was auctioning off oil and gas blocks in its territory. Addressing the media, Kenya's Foreign Affairs Principal Secretary Macharia Kamau said the alleged auctioning took place on the 7th of February 2019 in London, United Kingdom.
The government of Kenya cannot and will not stand by as its demarches are ignored and its territorial integrity is infringed upon and its sovereign resources are carved out and shared out by an ungracious and unbrotherly neighbor acting to satisfy the greed of commercial interests resident in foreign lands. Kenya's magnanimity towards its neighbors must never be taken for granted.
Many Kenyan soldiers have been killed in Somalia since their country's involvement with Somalia in 2011. Macharia says Somalia's decision to auction off oil and gas blocks in Kenyan territory was uncalled for.
Kenya is prepared and ready to defend its territorial integrity at any cost and considers all those directly or indirectly, whether Kenyan or non-Kenyan, in encroachment of Kenya's territory as enemies of the state and as adversaries of the people of Kenya. It is tragic and most regretful that the government of Somalia has chosen to take this action against a people and a state that has stood by the Somali people through incredible humanitarian and political hardships.
Kenya's sea boundary dispute with Somalia has been boiling for years. In 2014, Somalia sued Kenya at the International Court of Justice, ICJ, asking for a proper determination of the sea border between the two countries. The case is still pending, but ICJ judges allowed the case to go to full hearing despite Kenya's opposition to have alternative dispute resolution. Kamau says the federal government of Somalia does not embrace political maturity and diplomatic stand of a modern government.
By carelessly ignoring the internationally accepted norms of boundary disputes resolution and or political and diplomatic disagreements, the federal government of Somalia has sadly demonstrated that it has not yet attained and embraced the political maturity and diplomatic stance of a normal, well-adjusted and properly functioning modern government.
However, in a letter to Kenyan government, Somalia's Foreign Affairs Ministry has dismissed claims that it auctioned the oil and gas blocks in Kenyan territory. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Today is Monday, February 18th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Rescuers in Zimbabwe say they have recovered the bodies of at least 24 illegal gold miners from a flooded mine, but they say up to 50 more miners are missing. The government says as many as 70 miners may have been trapped after a dam wall collapsed and water rushed into nearby mining tunnels. The accident occurred Tuesday night, about 180 miles west of the capital Harare. Illegal gold mining has become widespread in Zimbabwe, and political analyst Rejoice Mgwenya says the Zimbabwe government does not regulate illegal mining because the miners are believed to be part of a syndicate connected to some senior government officials in the ruling ZANU-PF.
The issue of artisanal miners or these small-scale informal miners is a very big story generally around in Harare. Hararians are very much well-informed, but as usual, they are very skeptical about this story and they are not really very excited about it.
How can anyone be skeptical? It says up to 70 may have been trapped. The bodies of 24 illegal gold miners have been recovered.
Well, it ought to be a right viewpoint. But you see, this artisan miners issue is highly linked to ZANU-PF because there is a strong narrative around in Zimbabwe that these hustlers are part of a syndicate that is connected to the big boys in ZANU-PF. So Hararians generally and Zimbabweans generally are very skeptical. They are disinterested, really, because of the disaster that is always associated with this artisanal miner thing.
Are you saying, Rejoice, that the central government of Zimbabwe does not regulate this process?
You know, it is actually shocking that for a country that is such a sophisticated mining sector to allow this problem to perpetuate. The government kind of like formalizes this group of miners. They talk about them quite a lot. They say to be contributing the bulk of the 33 tons of gold. So the government does not regulate these individuals. They simply recognize them and they claim to support their efforts, which to me, I think it has always been, James, a disaster waiting to happen.
The government is saying that it will cost $200,000 to complete the rescue effort. Is the government saying that without that money, it would not be able to rescue everybody?
Well, let's put it this way, James. If the government has enough money to deploy a huge army across the country to molest and chase around citizens that are demonstrating, why would they not have? I even heard the chairperson of some mining civil disaster entity saying that she's appealing for donations. To me, that's very, very idiotic because this government has been able to deploy resources to suppress, you know, demonstrations. Why can't they have enough resources? If they are saying that the artisanal miners are contributing 80% to the gold ore in this country, why can't those resources be deployed to rescue them? So you can see the double standard and the hypocrisy around this mining issue because it is a political issue and they are trying to solicit sympathy from Zimbabweans.
Rejoice Mgwenya is a Zimbabwe political analyst. He was speaking with me from the capital, Harare. South Sudan's government says it will deduct a day's salary from each civil servant's paycheck for the next 4 months to raise money to pay for the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement. Some civil servants say they have not been paid in months. Winnie Chirino reports from Juba.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwe says the government made the decision because most countries in the international community have not yet supported the implementation of the agreement. Makwe says citizens should own the agreement by contributing financially to its implementation. The government spokesman says the Kiir administration will begin making the deduction from civil servant salaries beginning next month.
It is decided that all the public servants should contribute a one-day salary from their salaries for 4 months. That is 4 days' salary for the whole of the 4 months.
Marco says the money withdrawn from civil servants' salaries will raise about £1 million South Sudanese pounds. A public servant who prefers to be identified only as Solomon for fear of reprisals from the government says he is willing to contribute anything to support efforts to restore peace in the country, but says some government officials have stolen public funds. He says he hopes this time the money taken from public servants' paychecks will not be misappropriated.
It should not be a means of making other people's pockets failing. It should really go to what it is intended to. Anyway, whether I use in the right or the wrong way, then to me, I'm ready to contribute. It is a good decision.
But civil servant Susan Peter doesn't see it that way. Peter says she doubts the deductions will be used to implement the agreement. Besides, she says most public servants earn meager salaries as it is.
If we deduct this money, what will be remain for them? Because even those particular workers, those are receiving salaries, even these salaries is not enough. If we are going down to the marketing like that, this salary particular is nothing.
Civil servant John Donito likes the deduction idea, but hopes the money will actually be used to implement the peace deal. He says top government officials should contribute.
The idea is not bad, but it shouldn't be only civil servants. Other people should also be included, like the politicians, also the traders in the market, so that the value of the money can be able to run the peace process.
Makwe says the government will also approach the private sector for contributions and called on the international community to support the government during the implementation process of the agreement. He says the government needs about 44 billion South Sudanese pounds to implement the revitalized peace agreement. For VOA News, I am Mwini Sereno in Juba.
Gambia's Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission, the TRRC, over the weekend visited former President Yahya Jammeh's torture chambers at the country's former National Intelligence Agency, the NIA. In Banjul, the visitors found that the former intelligence agency had embarked on refurbishing the building amid allegations of evidence tampering. Now, new structures were also constructed on the property without the knowledge of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Pandere Umbai reports.
The visit of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission officials to the State Intelligence Services headquarters in Banjul followed torture claims made by multiple witnesses who have appeared before the commission. The spy agency has been under the direct command of dictator Yahya Jammeh over the years. It has been accused of torture and forced disappearances, and in some occasions, the abuse of women detainees. Usman Sow is the director general of the State Intelligence Services.
The human rights violation doesn't help national security. It hinders national security.
Sow was part of that widely feared intelligence agency, formerly known as the NIA. The NIA has been accused of terrorizing perceived political opponents, including journalists, for over two decades. So told the visiting TRC officials that after the change of government back in 2016, the SIS has undergone some organizational transformation. This, he says, includes the banning of torture, training of his staff on human rights, and the refurbishment of the building. But the chairman of the commission, Dr. Lamin Cisse, a former United Nations official, had a different view.
The review period that covers our mandate does not cover the issues that you just referred to. Our mandate, our review period is from July 1994 to January 2017.
Dr. Cisse says the TRC wants to establish what he calls a historical record about the alleged human rights violations committed under Jammeh's rule. Esa Fall is the lead counsel for the TRC.
It behoves all responsible officials to ensure that such investigations would not be interfered with. And what would that interference mean? It would mean taking steps to conceal or destroy evidence.
Fall's statement followed allegations made by a former senior staffer of the NIA, Babacar Badji, who has accused his former boss, Usman Sow, of allegedly authorizing the repainting of some of the torture chamber cells at the NIA, a charge denied by Sow, counsel Esa Fall again.
We came here prepared with two important documents. One is a cease and desist letter to request Your Excellency to stop transforming certain facilities of interest to the TRRC. If there is some transformation going on, stop that transformation until our inquiry is over.
the TRC officials were taken on a conducted tour of the NIA premises by Spy Chief Usman Sow. Sow has denied torturing detainees during his long years employment with the NIA. He also took the TRC team to one of the most widely feared torture dungeons at the NIA.
This is the famous Bambadinka building. This was the one that housed the Bambadinka shell. Okay. But it had offices as well.
Commission officials also observed that one of the cells at the NIA was repainted. But the SIA boss says that was news to him. The visiting TRC officials also discovered that a new mosque had been built at the NIA. Spy Chief Saul says the mosque was meant to instill religion in the staffers of the agency. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in Niger Republic, where Mali were crowned African under 20 champions on Sunday after beating Senegal 3-2 on penalties to win the CAF African under 20 championship. The much anticipated final had finished 1-1 after 90 minutes and extra time. Coming into the Sunday's final, Senegal had won all four of the matches they had played in Niger. All four semi-finalists, South Africa, Nigeria, Mali and Senegal, will now begin their preparations for the Under-20 World Cup, which kicks off in Poland in May. Some football fans react to the win this way.
I was surprised. I was totally amazed that Mali was able to defeat them, because I never believed Senegal would lose the match.
I'm sure it will not be the best of evenings for the Senegalese after losing their third straight finals on a stretch.
The Confederation of African Football, CAF, has officially approved the use of video assistant referee at the 2019 African Cup of Nations tournament, set to take place in Egypt from June 19th to July 21st, 2019. This will be the first time in the history of AFCON that video assistant referee will be used. The video assistant referee became famous during the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia. VAR was also used during the finals of the 2018 CAF Champions League between Egyptian giant Al Ahly and Esperance of Tunisia. It was also applied at the 2018 CAF Confederations Cup. In athletics news, as 800 meters world champion South Africa Caster Semenya prepares to take a fight against testosterone regulation to Switzerland, Bayana head coach Desri Ellis says the country is rallying behind its star runner.
As the Minister of Sport said, hashtag naturally superior. She hasn't taken anything, and I think it's against her dignity and human rights, and not just Caster, but they, you know, in other sports as well. So this is a groundbreaking decision that they're going to make, but we stand behind her, you know, through all the adversity that she's faced. She's come out on top.
The Court of Arbitration for Sport is due to hear Semenya's landmark case later today, where the double Olympic and three times world 800 meter champion will argue she's undoubtedly a woman. Elsewhere in Uganda, current world record holder for the fastest 10 kilometers event ever, Jacob Kiplimo, has won the Uganda National Cross Country 10 kilometers race. The teenager showed that age is just a number when he peeled away from the title holder and familiar foe Joseph Cheptegei, with about 1,200 meters to go to win in 28 minutes and 56 seconds.
I cannot fear anyone. You know, it's prepared. How are you prepared yourself for training? I cannot fear anyone. As long as you are prepared, yes.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sport. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission has again appealed to a fuming Nigerian public to trust its judgment over the postponement of last Saturday's election. Rotimi Oyakhemen, the chief press secretary to INEC chairman, says although Nigerians are disappointed, the commission is encouraged by their understanding that INEC has conducted free, fair and credible elections in the past years. And that's it for this Monday, February 18th, edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a productive week.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu, host of Health Chat. Tuesday on Health Chat, we will discuss measles, as some countries around the world are grappling with the disease. Our guest is Dr. Vincent Sojunu, Incident Manager with the World Health Organization in Madagascar. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.